Welcome to Automates, the podcast that brings you musings from thought leaders and industry pioneers who are shaping the way we work, think, and succeed. Each episode is packed with insights, expert interviews, and practical tips that will inspire and empower you to take your business to the next level. So tune in, subscribe, and get ready to innovate with Automates. So welcome, Alex. How are you? You well?
Good, thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me.
That's all right. No, it's my very pleasure. It's my very pleasure. I try and scour the earth to find super smart and super interesting people to talk to on this, because I am less
here we are.
Yeah, less than smart and less than super in that sense. But I'm always trying to find people who have got an interesting story, an interesting narrative, been on a journey, and I've got some opinions, and I know that you have some opinions, so this is a good thing. I was doing a bit of research yesterday and today, and we've met before a couple of times, and we've had a few beers and everything else, and but I had no idea that you were a partner at, was it Latham's? You're a partner?
Yeah.
So why don't you, your background is fascinating in terms of where you are and why you're doing what you're doing. Why don't you just give us a little bit of background about why I find you so interesting?
You know, that's a question you need to ask yourself, then.
Well,
right. Oh, you'll shrink. So used to be a traditional lawyer, trained at Norton Rose, went to American firm Shaw Pittman and then Latham to really learn my trade, because I was a total geek. So I qualified in, I think, 97, and I just rushed straight towards tech and technology law. Mm-hmm. It's kind of my interest. I almost did engineering at university and veered towards law at the last minute.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I learned to be a tech lawyer, and I was like the only person there teaching myself from a book who was like doing tech law. So I went to Shaw Pittman, I learned my trade there doing outsourcing, which is kind of where tech lawyers go if they have kind of M&A envy and kind of want to do big deals. So did that, learned my trade at Shaw Pittman, then moved to a year in New York, moved to Latham as a associate and team, and made partner there. And it was all great, right? I mean, I actually love doing the deals. I love the people, super smart people. But there was this kind of growing frustration that what we were doing just seemed a bit broken. And it seemed like very supplier-centric, very expensive. The incentives were wrong to making this better. I wasn't sure we were doing deals the best way. I think we were doing good work at what we did it. But like, I felt like we were fighting too much over points that didn't matter. And so there's this kind of growing sense of, you know, there's a problem with how the legal industry works. And you know, I'd been reading that very dangerous, you know, Richard Susskind. And, you know, I used to give a copy of his book to my boss every year. I don't think he ever broke the spine. You know, he kept churning them out. So I kind of was like, yeah, this is right. And I'd met a bunch of troublemakers in the States. So we're about 2009 at this point in the story. And I ended up writing this mission statement on a memo, very Jerry Maguire, to the executive committee of Latham & Watkins as a very junior partner, suggesting that maybe we look at innovation and fixed price and tech and process and the kind of things that many people would talk about back then, apart from Richard Susskind and a few others. But, you know, the standard fare of all conferences to date, you know, nothing's actually changed. Anyway, so Latham, when I wrote this memo, mission statement on a memo, 17 pages, they didn't fire me, but it became very clear they weren't going to make, you know, do anything. And more fool me, I think, for just completely failing how to understand how the legal market really works, because Latham Watkins made an absolute fortune, like doubled in revenue, doubled in partner profit by ignoring me, right? So, you know. But I believed my own bullshit. So I went and started Radiant in 2011, fixed fee only, no timesheets, focusing on contracts, very rapidly got into higher volume contracting because I thought that was more interesting to learn faster rather than the big deals. And here we are today still doing it.
Wow. I mean, I think the whole genesis of Radiant then was sort of that growing frustration. But I think
you probably then could be described as that sort of one of the very first sort of tech driven. I mean, they're everywhere. I mean, every conference, everyone's sort of driven by tech, yeah. Even more so now. Every day it gets more and more prevalent and driving that forward. But you saw I think what's really interesting is that you saw an opportunity for what I would call a tech-enabled business, but doing the business in the right way, like the right culture, the right people with the right grounding, understanding the right clients, the right type of work. So that's what I thought Radiant was. But I think in hearing you speak about it in terms of its genesis is really interesting, because you typically see at the moment, you see people where you were in 2009, 2010, building tech, not building an alternative law firm with an alternative model.
Yeah.
And I think
that's a really important point and it goes to one's theory of the world and theory of contracting, I think, at least, you know, because the fundamental question is, can we replace humans with computers and do we want to?
Yeah.
So there's a pattern, you know, you've seen it in terms of like a third, fifth year associate, often from a large firm, gets frustrated and goes off and starts a tech company. And there are lots of them around, right? They find a CTO, a co-founder who's a tech, and they go and build a company. And that's cool. But, and I see the attraction of tech, but I've always been of the opinion, I stay of the opinion that this is ultimately the contracting is about creating relationships, and relationships, even between companies, are between people. Mm-hmm. And that trying to replace everything with tech is problematic, because the world is way more complex than we can imagine. And as we try to make sense of everything and try to collapse it into a system that rules them all, I think that becomes a real problem in terms of actually making it work. But also that we need to be kind of purposeful about what we're trying to achieve here. And I think what we're trying to do is make the pain go away and get people to focus more in, you know, contracting, which I do, in terms of actually creating great relationships, which means figuring out how to really make it work, focusing on the commercials and the practicalities of it, and, you know, making sure it's what people want to buy and what they're able to sell and the price is right and so on. And then get the relationship going as fast as possible. And instead, what I fear is that one, we have bad, broken contracting everywhere. And secondly, people are trying to institutionalize it through technology, right? So, you know, freeze it. Yeah. So I am very pro-human. And although I hate the idea of people doing grunt work stuff that could be automated, the purpose of automation is to get all of that out of the way so that we're fast and reliable and so on, but that we also have the space to think more and create relationships and, you know, care about, you know, how to add more value.
Yeah.
And so I believe that this kind of area is fundamentally a service business rather than a tech business. I don't think you can replace everything with tech. And that therefore we've got to look at the tech as tools. And if you want to go into the business of building tools, that's cool. I mean, we build a lot of tech at Radiant. I love tech, you know, I love tools, but they're tools, right? And you know, we'll come no doubt to AI, but you know, we're going back round again of, oh yeah, we'll just replace everything with tech. And I'm not sure that's the best solution.
No, 100%. I mean, I think I say it a lot. People buy people. People buy for, I mean, the technology is a commodity, really. What we do, what you do, the tech-driven world, all of the different providers out there, there's 10 to a dozen workflow automation platforms like we are. But actually, you've got to have some parity in the technology. But ultimately, the way that you win is how you do business, the way that you look after your customers, and the way that you engage with them from that very first conversation. That sales process that starts pre-contract, for example, that is part and parcel of what we're doing. People buy people. People buy into the sort of the narrative, the story, and sort of how you do stuff. So I'm very much aligned in that sense. Now, I don't sit there doing contracts all the time, but sort of we try to build those kind of meaningful relationships before we've even got a relationship. There's nothing on paper. There's no concept of how we might solve or what problems we might solve for a client. But It's about, okay, well, is there some common ground? Do you think I'm a dick? Does that, you know, it's like, can we do some business together? Can we work together? Yeah.
And contracting should fit behind that process, right? That trust building, relationship building thing, which absolutely starts before the contract's put in place. Yeah. And so I think what happens often is that, you know, it becomes this disjointed conversation where there's, you know, the sales team is like trying to do exactly what you're describing. And then it goes to the lawyers, right? And you know, everyone's hearts sink. And then the lawyers come in with these ridiculous terms and the conversation becomes ridiculous. And then you're trying to like get it over the line and get back to building that relationship, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is unnecessary because I think most of the contract terms we send out are too long, too unreasonable. The conversations are not helpful because I think the points we fight over are not very valuable, frankly. And I think there's tons of data from World CC and so on about that. And that what really matters is are we enhancing and continuing to grow that relationship? I think what lawyers really do help is lawyering at its best is bringing a certain level of rigor to help think through, is this actually workable? Have we actually figured out? Are we all, you know, seeing eye to eye on this stuff? And if so, good, let's go ahead, right? So I think there is real value that can be added, but too often it's like there's a sales price and it goes completely sideways often to the legal thing and then we're clawing it back into relationships again. Yeah, and that to me seems completely backwards.
I think so. I was joking with a friend who's another software vendor and we were sort of saying that we chose the wrong industry to sell into because we're selling legal tech or tech. And so we're like, we could have avoided quite a lot of pain if we'd have just chosen a completely different route, different pathway. But I think that, so to your the promise and the premise of Radiant is to reduce conflict, simplify things, not just from your business operating model, but actually just the process of contracting. How do you do stuff? What do you do? And I think that sort of makes a lot of sense. I wanted to, you mentioned a couple of things in terms of the foundational things of what Radiant was, which was no timesheets, fixed price from day dot. There's been no concept or context of, okay, well, we're going to start charging by the hour, this or that, whatever it might be. There's lots of sort of alternative service providers. There's lots of other sort of mechanisms in the market or providers of services similar to sort of legal. I think I'm not a big fan of timesheets. I'm a big fan of fixed prices and understanding, okay, well, because it's on us to deliver an mm-hmm. outcome for something that we think is fair for us and fair for you guys as the buyer. How, as a concept, back in 2011, people have been talking about it and everything else, but nobody, I mean, it's still today. There's quite a lot of talk about it, but it still doesn't happen very often. Was that a point to pivot against the standards, or was that something that you believed in from day dot that you thought this is not just a differentiator, this is a fundamental way that we need to do the business because it makes sense?
Yeah, no, definitely the latter. It was just the right thing to do. And you know, clients obviously like it, not as much as I was expecting, interestingly. I mean, I think people hide behind the billable hours. It's easier. It doesn't actually require you to think what you're buying and so on. So, but, you know, I was so naive and innocent setting up Radiant. And so that was just one of a long list of examples. But apart from clients liking it and having the budgetary certainty, what it does is it means that we're incentivized to actually get smarter and figure out how to do it. And by putting us, we've never in the history of the firm gone back and asked for more money if something overran or took longer than expected or anything, right? And that, you know, is a kind of matter of honor for us. And so that discipline of not having an escape route and so on forces one to actually learn how to do it better. I don't think it's a coincidence that we started 13 years ago as fixed price only, and now we're the fastest on the planet at doing this, right? We're running it. Typically, we turn a matter in half a day. I mean, send it first thing in the morning, you'll get it back at lunchtime. So, you know.
Yeah.
And no one else is running anywhere close to that speed. And we do it because, you know, you spend a lot of time agonizing, not just about using tech and so on, but actually the process. And to me, the most important thing is the process, right? Yeah. The process and the experience. So like when people, the business, we have a 4.7 out of 5 customer sat from our business teams, right, who work with us. And the things they say is, one is, they've never seen the speed like it, right? And they love it. And law firms don't take it seriously, right? You know, you're having a conversation with a serious person on that about contracts because they go, oh, why are you so obsessed with speed? And I'm like, because that's what they care about, right? But the second thing is just how nice and flexible everyone is, right? We take all these young lawyers who come and join us, and they're all locally qualified lawyers because the team's in, like I said, Trinidad, South Africa, Malaysia. And we basically beat out of them everything that the law firms beat into them. This kind of initial period where we're like, we don't use long words. We're nice. And we get on the phone. We make it work. And we don't get sweat the small stuff. But we get the details right. And, you know, that stuff. So what people say is like, God, it's so lovely to work with these people because they just make the deal happen. And they're just nice. And they're friendly. And they get on a call and so on. So you're trying to have process and the rigor so you can do it. But then the utterly human experience of like, just go make a connection. Talk to them. You know, they've got like a pulse. Right? Don't talk down to them. You know, the stuff that's like pretty basic, but like, you know, uncommon, unfortunately. And so, you know, all of that together is so important.
Yeah. And so you spent, well, I guess, and you can tell me, you've got standard playbooks for things, you've got approaches to stuff. I saw a couple of months ago, I think it was maybe even 6 months ago, you were talking about the idea of continuous improvement, the idea of sort of that. And as you said, fixed price forces you to think about how you're doing stuff. And that's a constant. That is a constant because you're always wanting to do more, think about more, different types of work. So talk to me about your approaches to continuous improvement. And remind me what the conference, you went to a conference and you spoke at a conference and we talked.
Oh, yeah, it was Shingo.
Shingo.
So Shingo is Americans Ingenious Marketing, Utah State University's business school, grabbed one of the OGs from Toyota, and Toyota, you know, the creator of Lean, as the Westerns call it. They grabbed one of the guys, Shigeo Shingo, gave him an honorary PhD, got him to start writing down the model of how Lean works, and then started the Shingo Prize, which is colloquially known as the Nobel Prize of Manufacturing. So this is like the extreme sport version of Lean. I think Toyota would be nice. Right. Well done. Keep going. You know, another 100 years, you'll get there. But like, to the rest of the world, Shingo is about as high standard as it gets. Yeah. And once I saw that there was one of these things, I was like, I want one of those. No one in professional services ever won a Shingo Prize. No one in virtual company, sub-Saharan company, you know, Caribbean, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Right. It's like, yeah, I want one of those. So we hired a Shingo judge to come and work with us on like doing this. And I think we've still got a long way to go. But, you know, one day I hope we challenge for the prize. Right. Because it's just mad and exactly the kind of thing that Radiant does. So that was the conference. I think I was pretty much sure I was the first lawyer ever to talk at a Shingo conference, and the first lawyer, Shingo alumni, along with Ian and I, who've been doing all the course and so on.
But that talks to your vision. It talks to what your, it isn't, everyone talks about sort of different methodologies, agile, lean, this and that. Nobody really embeds it into their business in a deep and meaningful way. That's what they do, but very few organizations truly do it. No law firms do it.
No. I mean, there have been a few. Safar Shaw did a lot of excellent stuff with Lean and so on, but then I think they slightly lost their way, you know, change of leadership and so on. But I know their pocket's still there. But it is extreme and ridiculous. But to me, it just makes so much inherent sense that this is utterly focused on creating value for the customers. The principles like lead with humility and, you know, respect every individual, ensure quality at the source, and blah, 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 improve pull and flow and so on, all make utter sense as you look into it. I think it's utterly applicable to what we do. But we've got a long way to go on this, right? I mean, it's extremely hard, and that's fun. That's fun. But all of it is utterly aligned with our strategy, which is add more value for clients and learn faster, right? How to do it, because everything else will sort itself out after that.
Yeah.
And create an amazing experience.
And I think that this thing, you're, and I like the way you're talking about creating an amazing experience. But you're talking about creating an amazing experience where you're empowering your employees, the people that are doing the work, to have amazing experiences. They've got to follow them, but they are growing, they're learning, they're evolving. But ultimately, it's about delivering that client experience and expectation that, that they're sort of they're buying into and they get, and what you're now known for. I think that's it isn't typically what you hear. It's sort of, oh, we want to deliver a great client experience. They don't consider the impact of what delivering a great client experience is, does to the employees, because they start to think about it. But it's a holistic kind of view, which is really, it's really sort of, it's, there's a word, I can't remember. But anyway, carry on.
Mad.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
inspirational is the word I was thinking, not mad.
Okay, that as well.
That
too. Right. It's really interesting because you've got a huge tension lurking in what we're doing. One is, like, we've got to have processes and so on. And this is with lawyers, right? You say it's hard to sell to a law firm. It's also hard to run a law firm because, you know, lawyers are cats, right? And I think what you're hitting is, you know, the they're not normal as a cohort, right? So in order to make this work, you, A, need a framework. There's a wonderful expression from our judge helper, Chris Butterworth. Freedom within a framework, right? So you need to bring concepts which are really unusual in law firms, I think, around, you know, we're not just optimizing autonomy of partners, but we're actually going to have a framework in which we operate. We're going to have processes and we're going to have things. But then the freedom piece of, and I want you to go and fix and keep improving it, right? Yeah. So that's where the CI comes in. And so, you know, the term I keep using with the team is effortlessly delight the client. What we want to be in is a situation where I want you to be embarrassed in the future when the client effusively thanks you for your help on the deal and you feel you hardly did anything, right? That's what we're aiming for here, right? Them to be ecstatic and you to be embarrassed that they're so ecstatic, right? And so effortlessly delight the client is fundamentally about, I'm going to tell you that we need process. I'm not going to tell you what the process is. You're closer to it than I am. You go figure out what the process is. You keep improving it. You feel empowered, which is really hard to get people to feel empowered and, you know, have agency, but, you know, you struggle away. So that you don't have to do all of this nonsense in order to deliver a deal, right? So if we can make the contract shorter and clearer and more reasonable and relevant, and, you know, we can actually reduce the playbook rather than expanding it, because we've made these points go away, because there's no glory in negotiating things that don't matter. And, you know, we've kind of built these portals and done this stuff and generally made it like an incredible experience for the client and the other, and the other side. I think they are actually a stakeholder in this, you know, heretically enough. And so you can spend more and more of your time thinking about how to create even more value in doing improvements rather than just slogging away, just churning paper, right? We're not in the churning paper business. Contracts aren't the point. It's the relationship that's the point. Yeah. How can we add more relationship, more value there and so on? Close deals faster, create more value for clients. So that's what we're trying to do. But it's really hard, right? I mean, it's all very well me talking away on LinkedIn and, you know, on these podcasts. The reality is, it's a bloody slog to build this in and get there. And I feel like, you know, sometimes we underestimate how much progress we've made, but also we barely scratched the surface on what's possible here.
Yeah, but I think what you're striving towards. I mean, a lot of the traditional firms have got like LSP arms. They've got this. They've got that. Various other like efforts and coordinations internally to try and drive towards some of the things, but it's easy for them to fall back on the easy business, the old way of doing stuff, whereas you only do this. You only drive forward.
One of the things... Nuts. It's gone for another industry too. I mean, listen, we'll go and have another beer and figure out where we're going.
Yeah, I think we should.
It's mad.
But I think the way that I look at it is I do what I do in the way that I do it, but I only do that through a series of a few successes, but a whole bunch of failure, and failure not in, you know, I mean, you're always trying to hide failure from your clients, but ultimately if you don't fail, you don't see room for improvement. Or if you don't see those opportunities to do stuff, I always like chatting to people about this, and not everyone likes to open up, but I hope you do. But what are some of the slap in your face kind of moments where you've gone, we've got that so wrong. What do we do? How do we fix this quickly so that we can get back on track? I mean, in 13 years of doing what you do, striving forward for new ground and a new way of doing stuff, you must have hit things that have gone, yeah, we could do that slightly better, or that was completely wrong.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you can draw out that other people can go, actually, yeah, I can relate to that, without giving away too much?
So I think the starting point is I knew absolutely nothing when I started Radiant. I mean, the level of ignorance and naivety that were going into it was wild. And it was kind of interesting in 2013 when I realized that, like, you know, we were talking the good talk, but we were really following through. We'd actually fallen back on being a partnership, even though we'd set up as a company and so on, because that's what you do under stress. And we had a clue, like not a clue, right? So I brought in a guy called Greg Tufnell, who's a brother of Phil Tufnell. he's the former chairman of, CEO of Habitat and so on, like, I describe him as the least like a lawyer I could find. And I brought him in to be our non-exec chairman. And he's been fabulous, still with us. But I mean, I think he was quite wide-eyed when he realized how little we knew about running companies and so on, yeah. Put us through 101 bootcamp. So there was a huge amount of learning where everything we did was wrong, you know, in terms of running companies, building stuff and all the rest of it. So that was just kind of one example of like everything was wrong. And you know, there's some fantastic books like Traction and The E-Myth. And, you know, I really think that anyone doing this should really go and actually read The Business Basics and so on, you know, of like those books, because there is so much. I mean, general rule is there is so much to learn from outside legal, you know, like, and generally we don't go anywhere within the legal industry for consultants, advice or anything else, right? Anyone who comes to us and says, I've worked with lots of other law firms, it's like, good luck, mate, right? You're not for us, right? Because we're not. But well, as soon as you go outside legal, it's unbelievable what's there, right? Yeah. Of course, there's some wonderful people in legal, yeah, Paul Gilbert, Kira Fenton, so on. But like, you know, generally it's like you go elsewhere. So that's one thing. The other thing is that it's like a running joke. It's a running joke, but it's serious. Ian Teague and Ian runs delivery. We have a beer every year in January and December where we think back to everything we thought we knew in January and laugh at how it was wrong. And this is a really important... right? No, it's like a few beers. And this is super important. One, because you kind of forget otherwise how much you were like learning in the year, right? But also it builds, you know, I was talking about one of the Shingo principles being lead with humility, right? It is nothing like, you know, just remembering how you were so emphatic about at the beginning of the year about thinking something and yet it's like turns out to be completely wrong. And knowing that we'll have the same drink next year, laughing about what we thought right now.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's led me to is I made a ton of mistakes about overly locking stuff down into tech or overly locking down structures and so on that meant that we had to throw them all out again, you know, later and so on. And, well, I treat tech now as very disposable. Like we don't bring any systems in generally other than more generic platforms that are hyper flexible. And and although we build our own stuff, it's increasingly like just treat it as disposable and we'll you know replace it and so on later, and so that's been a major learning for us because you know the more you kind of recognize that you're going to change your mind next week, the more you can
build
flexibility. It's also why I've been so down on contract lifecycle management, because I see that as a repetition of these kind of mistakes of just trying to replace everything with one system that will solve it all, right? And the more you can build more, like, you know, your stuff, right, more generic stuff that can be recut, you know, every day if necessary, as you learn, the better. So
on that point, I see a lot of trends of people not buying sort of an out of the box ready to go CLM platform, all the big players that are out there, because everyone's just too unwieldy, but it prescribes a way of working. It doesn't give you that kind of flexibility.
Yeah.
Now, there is flexibility in almost everything, but that whole idea that you're going to change a whole team around a particular piece of tech to do a particular thing seems a bit bonkers. And I think that the market, particularly the buyers, they're sort of sat there thinking, okay, well, maybe there is alternatives. There's things that we can do.
And those things may already be in their company, right? I mean, just picking up the tools you've got and using them and so on. And, you know, there are a few things that I think are super helpful in the legal world that are not standard issue in enterprise stuff, but like document creation and so on. But, you know, outside those, the more you can just put, you know, use what you've got or put in very flexible systems. Mm. We ended up, like this is a don't do this at home kids kind of moment, but I ended up throwing out half our IT systems a couple of years ago and replacing them all with a home built ERP, which actually works, but that's like completely mad. But I built that in Airtable with a Stacker front end and you know, we have a lot of Zapier running behind it and so on. And but that has given us a much more flexible environment in which you can go, okay, Chris, that's wrong. Throw that bit out, blah, blah, blah. So build that flexibility. And then the other day we had an interesting experience where I saw something where someone had figured out a whole way of doing something, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, but they were working in a platform that I thought they were fighting. Mm. And as an experiment, I fired up EL ChatGPT and saw, can I just build a bit of software in, you know, a couple of weeks? And it's interesting. It's gone into production now. It's like 4 weeks later. And it's like a full React app based on Firebase and so on. And it works. And like, you know, kind of updating it as we go, because it's like, but it's actually solving, I think, a serious problem. And that is super interesting, right? That we're now in this age of like, A, the more you can go towards no code, low code tools and start to build stuff that works in your business and things, but also the more you can like, maybe you just create something, right? And that will be a disposable prototype, right? You know, will be thrown away and replaced and no doubt many times. But it, as a tool for learning, that is, to me, very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've heard quite a few friends out of industry down the pub on a Friday type thing. They're talking about, what do you know about this Gen AI thing? What do you know? I've got builder friends and various other bits and pieces. And they're trying to just make their lives a little bit easier. And I said, well, just...
Right.
Play around. If you've got an idea, play around with it. See what it can throw out. And sort of don't be limited by, don't ask it a question as you'd ask a friend. Just open, just say, put context around it. And it's really interesting. Sort of, you get these.
And you can ask it to help you ask better questions, right? You can improve your prompts, you know, with nonsense magic prompts. You can get that pretty fast, you know, including asking it, like, how would I improve this prompt? And give me the prompt to ask this right the next time after.
I've just given you a shit prompt. Can you make it 10% better, please? It's right. Like, of course I can. That's easy because it's a shit prompt.
It is a shit prompt. Yeah. Exactly.
You mentioned, you've talked a lot about culture. You've talked about sort of playbooks and giving people the power to think about what they do. But you also mentioned, so your Radiant is spread across multiple locations. You did mention it earlier on, but I was listening, but I forgot. So where are people based, and what?
So technically, we're an English law firm. I say technically because, you know, most people are not here. So we're ABS, you know, regulation, alternative business structure. The main team is in, well, the largest part of the team is in South Africa and mainly Cape Town, but also Joburg. And then we opened up in Trinidad a few years ago, so to cover the North American market, because you really want to be in time zone for contracts so you can do the court negotiations.
So you can do the speed, right?
Exactly. And then we opened up in Malaysia a couple of months ago. So now we're global. So that covers basically the zone, the 24/5 contracting. Yeah. So that's cool. That's really exciting.
And I think, so talk to me about, so I would imagine, so when I'm recruiting for a particular team or a function or a role or whatever it might be, I've got it in my head the type of person I want, the type of skills they've got. There's a job spec that I've written 20 months ago or whatever. But ultimately, it's very much about, okay, well, do I think I can work with this person? Have they got the same values as me? You talked earlier about sort of like lawyers getting untrained the things that big law have trained them. Do you find that there is an upcoming in the regions that you operate in, but also just hearing from the market in the UK and others, that there is this generation of lawyers coming through who are much more ready and prepared for your world versus big law? Is it much of a change that you have to sort of drive through somebody, or is it you find that people are picking up things because they're used to changing technology, changing their phones, doing things. So there's that sort of adaptability that perhaps might not have existed 13 years ago. I don't know. I'm just curious as to the dynamic of hiring.
Made me think. I suspect nothing ever changes. I don't think this generation is actually wildly different. You know, I think it's the right of every generation to moan about the next one and complain about the one above. And I expect them to, you know, it's like this is the right of every generation, you know, RITE. We hire about 2% of the people who come to us. And what we're looking for is spark, and they kind of, you know, look fun and they'll fit in and they want to do things differently. We're typically catching people on the way out of the industry. So even though they're very young. So we did this for 5 minutes and then stopped, is we set up a law firm in South Africa to train people and do the articles, whatever it's called, training, called that, can't remember. But and we got out of that because what happened is we'd take people, put that through it, and then they'd go, but now I want to go to a real law firm, right? And then they'd immediately bugger off. So what we do is, and I would say this to their face, and I do say this to their face, I've taken you in as a bird with a broken wing. So you've been through kind of your training contract in whatever, you've been brutalized by the local law firms who are, you know, pretty prehistoric, right? I think all law firms are pretty prehistoric, but you know, they're particularly, right? And you've gone, this is not for me. You've experienced, you know, what it's like, where you just, you know, everything's a crapshoot, whatever that partner feels like today and blah, blah, blah. And you want to go somewhere which is different and feels like it's more positive and more constructive and helping and yada yada. And so you end up at Radiant for the right reasons. And so we're kind of hiring them there. But when they come in, none of them have used any tech. I don't expect them to know that much. You know, if they, you know, slightly more qualified associates may know more about contract types, but I will still teach them, but we'll teach them all the tech. And they're generally shocked when they come in. They didn't believe us. In the interview process, right? They didn't believe us that we were different and really everything's about it. And they're like, wow. So on the first few days of their time with us, I give them the eyes wide open talk, listen, you know, we told you during the interview process, right? We are really keen on this improvement stuff and tech stuff and how we do things. And you didn't believe you did. And I'm like, yeah. You know, like everyone says that, grandpa. And then it's like, well, it turns out it's true, right? And
surprise!
And the thing that's going to happen next is you're going to, like, you know, feel like you're drowning because there's so much to learn and so much stuff. And also because, you know, lawyers, I think, are very high. It's not healthy correlation, or the kind of association between their sense of self-worth and their sense of how good they are at their job, right? You know, there's it's not great. And I think it leads to some of the problems in the industry. It's just the cohort of lawyers are wired. We're weird. And you know, therefore, if we're telling them that all of this stuff they've learned and they were desperately just trying to be good at something is all wrong, because we kind of are, right? That like to be aware that this is going to be quite tough emotionally for themselves, be kind to themselves, not drown. And, you know, because you'll have your eyes wide open at the end of this week and it'll even be worse at the end of the next week. So, and they get through it and then they, you know, find their feet and learn how to do it. And, you know, we ruin them for life. They don't generally go back to law firms after Radiant. They do go in-house. I describe us as a finishing school for in-house lawyers. You know, we're teaching them contracts and how to make things better, right? It's like good skills.
I think do you see that as a good thing? Then obviously you want to keep good people. You want to keep the thing, but actually every good lawyer you plant into a good corporate, you're making that incremental.
Yeah, I mean, this is the old thing that the McKinseys of the world did, right? I think that's how they got so successful. I mean, occasionally it happens, I am relaxed about the idea that people won't be with us for life. No one does that. You and I haven't done that. In fact, most people, you know, people we know, right? Look, none of them did it, right? It may have got a bit faster now, but still. So I'm relaxed about it as long as, you know, they feel like, and we feel like they've really learned enough. So one of the things that I worry about is people feeling like, I've done a bit of CI, I've done a bit of contracts, I've done that contract once, you know, I'm done. Yeah. And I think there is so much to learn about so many different aspects of just the things that Radiant does, let alone in the world itself, the more people can, like, focus a little bit more on mastery and a little bit less on ticking the boxes, the more they will get out of life and enjoy. But, you know, you moan about it and you just sound like, you know, kind of a boomer and grandpa, you know, whatever, right? So I do my best, but I am resigned to the idea that people will move on faster than I'd hope, right?
Yeah, but I think that I had a conversation with one of my consultants this morning. We're talking about career progression and everything else, and he's a young sort of professional. I said, mate, I don't expect you to be with me in 2 years' time, because you've been with me for 2 years. If I'm still asking you to do the same job in 2 years' time, I'm expecting you to be gone. I need you to be doing, so let's build a pathway. Let's create this plan for what happens going forward. Now, I don't want to lose you, don't get me wrong, but I'm not naive to the fact that there's an average. People stay in jobs for an average of 2 point whatever it is years, and that is only going lower with post-COVID and the transitory nature of everything. And I think that's just a reflection of it. But you try and create the right culture to keep people for the right reasons, rather than just the inflated salaries and the reasons around that. You know what I mean? So
100%. And you know, we scenario spend a lot of time working on, because I want people to stick around longer and learn more, right? Mm-hmm. Not just, you know, new stuff. And that makes it incumbent on us to do, you know, as much as possible in terms of development and, you know, opportunities and so on. But I don't think we're going to suddenly turn people into lifers. I'm just not seeing
that. I mean, I think, but that's the thing. You sort of, you create an environment that is interesting. They're doing good work. They feel valued. They feel appreciated by you and by their clients, the people that they're working with and dealing with. And that's sort of what you need to do. Talk to me about your book. You've talked during the last sort of, I don't know, 40 minutes about the idea that Radiant's here to improve contracting for all parties, your clients, them, the other sides, the lawyers that are actually doing it, the business stakeholders who don't understand the long words like me and all the other sentences that are in there.
We don't need the long words, but
So obviously, so you're somebody that's written two editions of the book now?
Two editions in the book, yeah.
Talk to me about it.
Yeah, so it's a book called Sign Here, Enterprise Guide to Closing Contracts Quickly. And it's funny, I was told by someone, you had to write a book in order to be, you know, like taken seriously. It's a marketing thing and so on. And what you're meant to do in the book is like show a bit of ankle and get them, like tell them the problem and then give them a hint of a solution, but not the answer. Yeah. And then, you know, you just create market. And that was like not very radiant, not very like helpful. So I actually just try to give everything away, which is kind of how we improve things. And it was a fabulous experience writing the book. I mean, obviously it's agony and, you know, pulling teeth and so on, but it was during COVID, right? I didn't learn to make sourdough bread, you know, it was my sourdough. But it was good because it almost made the noises in the head stop for a couple of weeks because you know, the voices, because get the voices right, man. It forced me to figure out what it is we do and kind of come up with a framework around how to reason about how to do contracting well and how to actually improve it. So that was kind of edition one. And then two things happened, like contract lifecycle management happened massively, you know, it existed, but it became a real thing, and you know, bloody AI happened, right? And love it, but worry about how people reason about it. And I thought I had to do an update edition, which came out this year on the topic. But what I also realized was I'd done it all wrong before. And this is kind of very analogous to the lean journey. And I was talking about lean and sugar, because often what happens is you start with the tools, right? You're going to have five whys and I don't know, PDCA, and yada, yada, right? And so on. And five S's and what have you. People focus on the tools and then they slowly realize, oh my God, it's full of stars, right? It's a philosophy. It's a whole way of thinking, right? And then you're really lost and then you end up becoming a wizened old person. you know, whacks people on the head with sticks and says, wrong thinking, right? You know, I think that happens to all lean practitioners. And I kind of, I think I'd made that mistake with the first version of the book because it was very focused on tools and this is how you do it. And they put this in place. You need technique, you need this and this and this. And that's great. And it's all true. But it was much less about the philosophical stuff and also the behavioral stuff, right? And what is why Shingo is so hard to do and why it's so interesting to me is its key focus on two things. One is systems thinking as in the broad sense of like, you know, rather than just tools and process number. The whole how do you work, whole thing works. Sum is greater than its parts. And second, it's all about behavior and not just focusing on we need good results, but what are the ideal behaviors that the team's going to exhibit? And, you know, getting the team to actually think about how do they want to work and what is it that's getting in the way of how they want to behave? These are harder questions. This is harder stuff, right? Yeah. And so the new edition of the book has much more about behavioral stuff, about thinking about, I think, more as a systems thing. Deals with CLM and AI and yada yada and so on. And I think there are uses and points and blah, blah, blah. But it is starting, it's been on my growing journey of like thinking actually, oh my God, there's like a lot of stuff that I missed the first time around. Like, you know, I think I ducked it as too hard. And now I'm like, no, it's too important that we need to actually talk about this kind of behavioral stuff, philosophical stuff, as well as tools.
So, you said something at the beginning there where you as you were writing it, you were thinking about how you do stuff and what. So how much of the writing process of edition one or edition two went back directly back into Radiant and how you did things? Because did it force you to think about, I'm writing something, but actually we don't even do it at home, let alone tell people it. So
there have been a few examples of that. Okay. And also what's been fun about it is it's been a trigger of a whole series of conversations. So there's like kind of wonderful people out there, kind of Jeff Carr is one name that comes to mind. There are lots of them, right, who've been so generous in sharing their ideas around, other things you could think about and what they've used and so on. So I think there is a value in starting to build a structure of, I think these are the kind of the types of tech in the market, or these are the types of things you can do to improve stuff, is people go, oh yeah, you've missed one, right? Here's another one and so on. So that's awesome. And there have been certainly things where I come back and like, oh, well, shit, we ought to do this ourselves and so on. And also over this period, especially because of the Shingo journey, we've been like, really codifying how we do things with the processes, and that's led us to whole stuff and building all sorts of things. And so we've got a learning cycle going on there of, I mean, it's a journey and, you know.
Well, I think nobody gets everything right 100% of the time, and nobody does. So it's like.
Well, I'm glad to report that I'm consistent with that. I don't know if I get it all right very often at all.
No, I'm very, 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 very simple. Very simple. So where can you get the book? Not that you want to plug in.
But actually much better. Go to radiantlaw.com and click on book and we'll send you a free copy. So how about that?
There you go.
You can download a PDF, but I'll send you like a paper.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah. Alex, I've loved this conversation because it's all of the things that I thought I knew about you, but the layer below by which it is sort of, you're a driven sort of, dedicated, principled person. You care about what you're doing. You're really trying to drive change, and I completely respect that. There's a lot of hot air and a lot of noise where we operate around sort of people moving with the time. Like, you know, a lot of it's a load of it is noise, but you walk the walk, you talk the talk, and I love that. It's awesome.
Ben, well, it's very generous, very generous. I feel like we're stumbling through, but. It's been a fun journey so far, and I'm still enjoying it.
But when you say stumbling through, but when you are at the leading or the bleeding edge of what you're trying to do in an industry that is so 1920s processes, you know what I mean? Not 20s, you know, maybe 30s, 40s, whatever. But you're really trying to change the perception of not just how you lawyer, what you do, but it's the whole ethos around it. And I sort of applaud.
No, Ben, but like you go and hang out with the Shingo gang and it is utterly humbling. I mean, you're like, oh my God, that's what serious people look like. You're like, this is the
go up to the guy. I found my tribe, and they're like, who are you? And who let the lawyers in? Like,
can we get rid of them?
And I'm like, no, I'm one of you. They're like, you're, but they're very kind, they're very polite. And but my point is, like, you go and see some of these companies, right? And you're like, it's unbelievable, right? I wrote a piece called On Being Unreasonable. It's on LinkedIn. And I talk about my experience going to a Toyota services center in South Africa. And it was like an extraordinary experience for me. I, like, once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. And I highly recommend to anyone who just has a nagging sense that it could be better to go and get on a tour at one of the Toyota, one of the Shingo places, one of the places taking Lean seriously, and you will be blown away. And so, Ben, you're very generous and you're very kind, but I'm like, seriously, like, once you've seen that stuff, you're like, God, I feel like such an amateur. And that's fun. Nice to have something to work towards. And they'll all go, oh, yeah, we've got such a long way to go. And we were like, I'm like, this is amazing. So, yeah.
But I mean, but I think everyone's on a journey and everyone's at a different place. And I think that's the thing. But everyone needs somebody, something to look up to. And if you can be that shining light for organizations and everything else, then that's a good thing. You know?
Nice. But go find a better hero is my advice. And like, go look at the Lean stuff and go and see what they're doing, folks, because that stuff is wild.
Well, I will go find a better hero. Alex,
there you go. Thank you, Ben. I would love to have a beer soon.
Yes, we will do that. Definitely. Take it easy, buddy. Keep well.
All right. Thank you.
Cheers, bud. Bye. Cheers.